had read his mind. A man entered, plugged in the cord for the light, and there in the doorway was a bloodied and battered Richards. Two men were at his sides, holding him up. His wrists were bound in front of him with duct tape. The red marks on his chest confirmed what they'd been doing, although it wasn't all. Richard's face was beaten and swollen, one of his eyes completely shut. Syed entered the room, a man following him with a chair similar to the one Hurley was in. He showed the man where to place it and said to Hurley, "How are you feeling today?"
"Great,"
Hurley said with enthusiasm.
"You guys really do a nice job of making people feel comfortable."
"Yes," Syed smiled. "I'm sure you would show us the same hospitality if we were in your country."
"Slightly better,"
Hurley said, flashing the new gap in his teeth.
"You know how competitive we Americans are. We didn't put a man on the moon by making our women walk around in sheets all day and blowing ourselves up."
"We all know that was faked."
"Sure it was,"
Hurley said, agreeably as they placed Richards in the other chair. One of the men produced a knife so he could cut Richards' duct tape. Hurley wanted that knife and in Arabic asked,
"Where's my buddy Roddy? Either of you boys ever get a blowjob from his mom?"
Hurley then launched into an invective-filled description of the sex acts that Roddy's mom used to perform for him. Syed would never admit it, but this American's descriptive abilities were in a league of their own. In fact, the descriptions were so detailed that even he wondered for a second if it could be true. Hurley read the unsure looks on the faces of the two goons and said,
"You really didn't know Roddy's mother was a whore? You should try her sometimes. She's getting a little up there in age, not quite as tight a fit, if you know what I mean."
Hurley winked at them as if they were of the same mind. "That will be enough," Syed said. He ordered the men to finish taping Richards' wrists to the chair. When they were finished, he told them they could wait outside. Hurley smiled at them and waited until they were at the door, and then shouted,
"Don't forget to ask Roddy about his mother. Dirtiest piece of ass I've ever had."
The door closed with a click. Syed placed his hands on his hips and let out an exasperated sigh.
"It's true,"
Hurley said, punctuating his words with an emphatic nod.
"The woman was a sex machine. She should have paid me."
Doctrine told Syed he should ignore the comments, but he felt that he needed to say something.
"You are a very interesting man, Mr. Sherman. You must be very unsure of yourself."
"Why do you say that, Colonel?"
"It is so obvious. Do I really have to say it?"
"Well, unless I've learned how to read minds since we last saw each other, I suggest you spit it out."
"You are afraid you won't be able to stand up to my methods. So you are trying to enrage my colleague to the point where he kills you."
Hurley screwed on a confused look.
"Colonel, you give me way too much credit. I'm not that smart. I'm just a horny bastard who slept with a ton of prostitutes. One of them just happens to be Roddy's mom."
Syed laughed at him.
"You are an unusual man."
"What do I have to do to get you guys to take me seriously? I'm going to lie to you about a lot of shit, but I am dead serious about Roddy's mom, and I'm not knocking the woman. She was amazing. And besides, you can't blame a woman for trying to put some food on a table, can you?"
Syed thought about that for a second and simply shook his head. It was time to take charge again. He wheeled his little cart over and checked his instruments. When he was ready, he broke open some smelling salts and stuck them under the other American's nose. Richard snorted and opened his eyes. Turning back to the foul-mouthed older one, he said,
"Your friend, Mr. Richards, was kind enough to give us his name."
"Never heard of him."
"Yes, well, let's see if we can jog your memory. This is what we are going to do."
Syed picked up the tin snips and said,
"I will ask you a question. If you refuse to answer or lie, I will cut off one of his fingers."
"Cool."
Hurley straightened up as much as the tape would allow.
"I'd like to see you cut one off right now. Go ahead. Let's get started."
"Mr. Sherman, what is your real name?"
"Come on, cut his finger off. Cut his wrist off. That would be really awesome."
Richards was awake now, a panicked look in his eyes.
"What the hell?"
Syed said, "He has already told us your name, but I want to hear you say it."
"Fine. William Tecumseh Sherman. Are you happy now? Can we go home?"
No, that is not the name he gave us.
I think I'd know my own name.
Last chance, Syed placed the tin snips around the first knuckle on Richard's left hand.
William Tecumseh Sherman.
Wrong answer. Syed pushed the two red handles together, and there was a quick snip and the pinky fell to the dirty floor. Richards started screaming, and Syed quickly moved the snips over to Hurley's pinky.
"Your turn," he yelled. "Name!"
Hurley had already turned his head away, as if he couldn't bear to watch what was going on. He started to move his lips and mumbled a name.
"Louder, I can't hear you."
Hurley slowly turned his head, made eye contact with Syed, and then looked down at his pinky. The distance was about right. He pretended he was starting to cry, while again mumbling, and when Syed moved just a touch closer, offering up his good ear so he could hear better, Hurley lunged forward, tilting his head to the right. He caught the top third of the man's left ear between his teeth and clamped down with all of his strength, grinding and chewing and growling and then yanking his head back. Syed screamed and broke free, his hands clamped round his bloody ear. He stumbled away and then turned to look at his subject. What he saw horrified him. Bill Sherman had a chunk of his ear hanging half out of his mouth. The insane American smiled at him and then started chewing on the ear, crunching it like a potato chip. Chapter 58. Rapp looked out across the city. Night had fallen, and that scar known as the Green Line now looked like a wide, formidable river, a black swath of darkness that cut the city in half. But travel 2 blocks in either direction, and there were signs of life. Buildings lit up with inhabitants, traffic moving about the city, horns blaring, and underpowered engines revving, all the normal sights and sounds of a city, but not in that desolate corridor. Only twice in the last hour had he seen a car dare cross no man's land. It appeared the ceasefire was activated, as they usually are, by segregating the various factions. He couldn't see the east-west streets to the north, and it was likely that more cars had crossed in that sector, but not enough to change what was obvious. This was literally a city torn asunder. The problem, as Rapp saw it, was fundamental geography. He was on this side, and they were on the other side, the they being Hurley and Richards. The only way to save them was to go over there, but Ridley had explained to him that going over there was a very bad idea. Going over there would result in his being captured, tortured, and then killed in that order. Rapp's response to Ridley was, "So you're pretty much admitting that Stan and Bob are going to be tortured and killed?"
"I'm admitting no such thing."
"The hell you're not," Rapp said, his frustration finally boiling over. Ridley shot back, "I know you're the new Wonder Boy, so this might be hard for you to understand, but there are things that are going on that you have not been read in on."
"Like what?"
"Things that are way above your pay grade, rookie." Ridley caught his mistake and tried to temper his words by adding, "Listen, I don't make the rules. There are certain protocols that I have to follow. Langley tells me who I can share things with. If you're not on that list, my hands are tied."
"Like Petrosian, for instance.
I'm sure you cleared that with Langley. You telling a foreign national that I was the man who killed Sharif?" Rapp watched as Ridley looked away. "Are you fucking kidding me? There's no way in hell you got approval from Irene to give him that information." Ridley sighed.
"We need Petrosian in this one, and the man does not trust strangers. So I gave him a little piece of information that I knew would please him. He hated Hamdi Sharif more than any person on the planet. It goes back to the beginning of the Civil War here. They were both arms dealers, and they agreed not to sell weapons to Fatah. Petrosian lived here, and he felt that a militarized Fatah would only prolong the fighting. About 6 months into the war, he found out that Sharif had broken their agreement and was selling weapons to the radical Palestinians. Petrosian was right. It prolonged the war, destroyed the city, killed thousands more, and Sharif became a very wealthy man. Petrosian vowed to kill him, but Sharif never set foot in the city again."
"Fine, so you used what I did for your own benefit, which means you owe me. I deserve to know what in hell is going on."
Rapp could see Ridley was at least thinking about it, so he pressed him a little harder. "That could have just as easily been me that got picked up. I deserve to know what Langley is doing to try to get them back."
"They're working on different levels. Signal intercepts, applying pressure where they can, calling in favors. What in hell does all that mean? It's complicated, is what it's supposed to mean, and on top of that, Stan, your friend Bobby, and you aren't even supposed to exist. How the fuck do you expect them to go to the State Department with that one?
Excuse me, he said in a falsetto. Two of our black ops guys, who don't actually exist, were kidnapped in Beirut. Could you help us get them back?
Bullshit.
Bullshit? What in the hell is that supposed to mean?
It means it's bullshit. If you think the State Department is the answer to our problems, if Langley thinks they're our solution, we're fucked.
I didn't say they were the only game. I told you it's complicated, and what the hell would you know? You're a damn rookie. A rookie who's smart enough to know this is bullshit,
Rapp yelled. You know what the solution is. You just don't want to say it because you, Rapp pointed at him, and all of the other pussies back at Langley don't have the balls to follow through on it.
Please enlighten me, boy wonder. What's the solution?
We do what the Russians did.
What the Russians did?
Ridley mocked him. Yeah, back in the mid-80s. After four of their diplomats were kidnapped. Ridley's gaze narrowed.
Where'd you hear that story?
Stan.
For Christ's sake,
Ridley muttered, obviously not happy that Hurley had told Rapp the story. Two diplomats and two KGB guys get snatched by one of the Palestinian factions. One of them happens to be the KGB's station chief here in Beirut. The Russians know what happened to the CIA's station chief when he got kidnapped, because they paid for the information that the Iranians sucked out of him. They don't want to see all of their operations exposed, so they send in a joint force of Spetsnaz and KGB goons, and they start whacking people. Ridley was shaking his head.
That's not the answer.
Really? Since you appear to know the story, tell me how it ended.
Ridley shook his head.
Nope.
One was killed, and the three were released, Rapp said. And how many Russians were kidnapped after that?
Zero,
Ridley reluctantly admitted.
That's right, and how many Americans?
Ridley shrugged.
Not zero. So what's the lesson to be learned?
We're not the Russians.
That's your answer.
Listen, I know you're frustrated. I'm frustrated, but I'm telling you, this is way above both of us. There are a lot of really important people who want this ceasefire to last. They will never allow us to go around shooting people like the Russians did.
But the Palestinians can keep kidnapping our people?
Rapp waited for Ridley to give him an answer. That wasn't coming anytime soon.
Like I said, this is bullshit.
That had been more than 3 hours ago. Rapp and Ridley had not exchanged words since then. Rapp had dumped his anger into studying maps of West Beirut, reading the intelligence reports, and trying to come up with some way to prevent this disaster from following the course of the previous hostage negotiations. Anyone who didn't understand where this was headed was either deluding himself by ignoring history or just too stupid to connect the dots. Out of this frustration came the realization of what it would all mean to his own future. He'd spent years thinking of little more than how he would make the other side hurt. And now, after all of his training, right when he was getting started, it would be derailed. Hurley and Richards would end up telling them everything they knew about him. His career would be over. The anger welled up inside him, and as he looked out across the city, he could feel himself drifting further and further away from the people pulling the strings in D.C. Their half-measures and dithering disgusted him. It was like Hurley had told them on the drive down from Hamburg, we got soft in the 80s and let these assholes get away with way too much shit. Apparently Washington still hadn't learned its lesson. Ridley joined him on the veranda. He was holding two beers. He set one in front of Rapp and took a swig out of the other. Rapp eyed the beer and then said, I'm not in the mood. Shut up and drink and listen for a change. I've been doing some thinking. This thing isn't going to end well. Cummins was bad enough. Stan, the shit that guy has in his brain, the stuff he's seen over the years. Ridley shuddered at the thought of the enemy getting their hands on all that information. I can't even begin to calculate the damage. He paused, took a swig of beer, and shook his head. Someone needs to do something, and you seem like just the kind of crazy asshole that would volunteer for a mission like this, although it's actually not a mission. There's nothing official about it. In fact, I'm going to get so pissed tonight that I pass out. And then when I wake up in the morning, and you're not here, I'll call Langley and tell them you've gone AWOL.
And where will I be? Rapp asked.
Petrosyan will be here in 1 hour. He has arranged to take you over to the other side. The police chief, no less, is taking you.
Rapp was surprised. The same asshole who snatched Stan?
One and the same.
Can I trust him?
Absolutely. How? Because this time he has given Petrosian his word that nothing will happen to you.
And I should be impressed by that?
Yes, you should. The chief will drop you off at a small hotel a few blocks west of Nimjes Square. And then you're on your own. My advice is you spread some cash around, telling the hotel manager and the vendors that you would like to meet with Colonel Asif Syed. They will claim they've never heard of him, but they all know who he is. They will tell him you're looking for him, and he will have someone collect you before the day is out. Then it'll go one of two ways. Ridley took another drink and organized his thoughts. He will either sit down and negotiate with you, in which case Petrosian has agreed to bankroll you to the tune of $1 million.
You're kidding me.
No. He is a man who likes to show his gratitude, and besides, he just eliminated one of his top competitors. He's bound to pick up a few more contracts.
Will $1 million do it?
Doubtful, but it will let them know we are serious, and they all know Petrosian is not a man to be fucked with.
So if it's not enough money, Ridley waved him off,
I'm going to be working on getting more.
Langley?
Maybe. Hope you have some other options. I just need to see if I can pull it off.
Rapp thought about the money that Hurley had taken from the Swiss bank accounts. He almost told Ridley, but decided to keep it to himself for now.
That's option one. What's option two?
They throw you in the dungeon, and they torture you, and eventually kill you.
But I'm a rookie, so how much harm can I really do?
It was a statement, not a question.
Something like that, a pawn for a bishop, Ridley shrugged. Maybe you even get lucky and take a few of them down with you.
Ridley drained his beer and looked to the west.
There's one last thing. The story about the Russians.
Yeah.
Stan didn't tell you the whole thing. The Russians, they wiped out a couple of families, women and children included. Fucking butchers.
Ridley shook his head, trying to get rid of the bad memories.
We're not the Russians. We don't kill women and children. At least, not intentionally. Never forget that.
Chapter 59 Syed held the small mirror in his hand, turned his head to the right and checked his bandage, carefully fingering the edges. The morning sunlight came through the window of his room, providing ample light. There was no hope of reattaching the jagged hunk of cartilage and skin, at least that's what the doctor had told him, although Syed suspected that the man was not well versed on the most recent medical advances. When all of this was over, which he hoped would be very soon, he would have to go to Paris and see if there was a plastic surgeon who could do something about the nub that was now his ear. Growing his hair out would help, but Syed did not want to live the rest of his years with such a permanent reminder of his time spent with Bill Sherman. That was still the only name he had to go on. The other man, Mr. Richards, had told them he did not know his boss's real name. As to whether he was telling the truth, Syed would only know that after a few more sessions, and depending on how the bidding went, he might not get that opportunity. One thing was certain, Mr. Sherman's sanity was no longer up for discussion. In the nearly 20 years that Syed had been doing this, he had never encountered anyone close to this animal. The man was clearly insane. How else could you explain biting off someone's ear and then chewing it? The all-too-fresh memory caused Syed to shudder. He'd never experienced anything so strange in his life. The pain had been bad, excruciating at the time, but it had faded. The image, though, of another person chewing on his ear had only grown stronger. He did not like it one bit, and it made him all the more anxious to get through this day and be done with this Bill Sherman or whatever his real name was. Syed finished buttoning the fresh white shirt that Ali had fetched for him and then put on his suit coat. He heard footsteps coming down the hall and turned to see Radi standing in the open doorway.
You wanted to see me?
Yes. How are our neighbors across the street?
Nothing new. We estimate they have between 30 and 50 men.
And us?
32.
Syed nodded and thought the number enough to handle a problem should one arise. Changing subjects, he said, You have heard about this new American, the one who is staying at the Shady Cedar?
Roddy nodded. Two of my men have been following him this morning.
He held up a two-way radio. They have sent me regular updates. They say the man is a fool. A fool, Syed said, finding the word an interesting choice.
He is wandering around the streets
asking merchants for information about kidnapped Americans and mentioning your name. He's handing out money and telling people where he is staying, telling them he is here to negotiate their release.
Syed was not surprised that his name was being mentioned. Chief Haddad had told him everything. The fact that Petrosian was sticking his nose into their business did not surprise him. He had known when he sent the chief into the Bourge to grab the two Americans that there would be repercussions. That was why he had to pay Haddad such an outrageous sum. Syed could tell something was bothering Radi, so he asked, "What is wrong?"
"I am worried that some other faction will grab him. In fact, I will be amazed if he makes it to lunch and if someone else gets him."
He made a pained expression and a clicking noise. "It could complicate our negotiations."
"Yes."
Haddad had told Syed that the new American was young, inexperienced, and very nervous. Radi was right. If one of the other factions grabbed him, they would try to ransom him, which would make things more complicated, especially if he wanted to complete the entire transaction today. There was another angle that he had just considered but could not share with the others. If the Americans were serious about bidding, they were likely to drive the price far beyond what he was hoping to get. In the end, it was unlikely that Bugnia and Bedreddin would agree to hand them back to the U.S. government, but it was worth a try. The smart thing to do was to take this new variable out of play and see what the Americans were willing to offer. "Why don't you pick him up? But be very careful. You know how sneaky the Americans can be. Take him someplace first and strip him down. Make sure he isn't carrying any tracking devices. Then bring him here and show him the rabid dog in the basement. Find out how serious they are about making an offer."
"You are not seriously considering handing them back to the Americans?"
Maybe not, but Syed was at a minimum willing to consider his options. America was a very wealthy country. Maybe they could make up all of their lost funds, and then some. Syed could put himself back on the road to a life of opulence. Knowing how unhinged Radi was about the American, Syed knew he would have to keep these thoughts to himself. "No, I am not, but I would like to see if the Americans can help drive the price up a bit." Radi stared at him for a moment and said,
"You should let me kill him. Remove all temptation."
"Can I trust Radi with these prisoners today?" was the question Syed asked himself yet again. It would be nice if he could convince Mugnia to come keep an eye on things, but he wanted to be part of the negotiations at the airport. Syed understood his colleague's anger, but he could not understand his persistence. The man simply did not understand what was at stake here today. He supposed a great deal of it was due to his youth. He could crawl back to Sabra and Shatila and rely on his black market trades and the payoffs he received from all of the impoverished refugees. He had many years ahead of him and many opportunities to rebuild his wealth, and he did not have to answer to Damascus for missing funds. Still, none of these points would matter to him. His judgment was clouded by his hatred. Normally, he would chastise Radi or humiliate him, but not this time. They just needed to get through today, and then things would return to normal. He decided on a more mature approach. Not wanting to argue with him, he said, "I understand your anger, but you are better than this, Abu." Radi shook his head.
"I do not think so. My heart is filled with nothing but hatred for this man. I will not sleep until I have killed him."
"And that is understandable. But you must take comfort in the fact he will die 1,000 deaths at the hands of whoever buys him today. He will experience more pain than we can even begin to imagine."
"None of that matters to me. I must kill him with my own hand."
A compromise occurred to Syed, one that he would never have to honor, but one that might be enough to keep Radi from ruining their chances of refilling their coffers. "I promise you, Abu, that whoever buys him today, I will make the transaction contingent on the other party agreeing that when they are done with Mr. Sherman, you will be given the honor of killing him." Syed watched the Palestinian turn this idea over in his hate-filled mind. He could see that he was not quite convinced, so he said, "And I will allow you to spend some time with him today, so he can be taught a proper lesson before he leaves." A thin smile creased Radi's lips, and he said,
"I would like that very much."
"Good," Syed said, placing his hand on his shoulder.
Now go get this other American and make sure no one is following you. Bring him back here and we will see what he has to say, and then I will give you some time to take out your frustrations on Mr. Sherman.
Chapter 60. Rapp sat on the edge of the hotel room's bed, tapping his foot. It was 10:09 in the morning, and he was having a hell of a time trying to calm his nerves. All he'd brought along was a small duffel bag that Ridley had helped him pack. Petrosian had come back to the safe house after his dinner with the police chief to go over the plan. He was not optimistic that Rapp would succeed, but agreed that doing nothing was a worse alternative. So, shortly before midnight, Rapp was shuttled from Petrosian's armor-plated sedan to the Beirut police chief's four-door Peugeot. Rapp wasn't thrilled about the idea at first, but when Petrosian explained that the chief was eager to make amends for his lack of judgment the day before, Rapp went along with it. Petrosian also knew that the chief would tell the right people that another CIA man had shown up and was looking to negotiate the release of his colleagues. They made it through the checkpoint fine, but Rapp had to resist the urge to shoot the smug little turd of a police chief and both of his men. It would have sent a nice message, but ultimately the wrong one, considering his final objectives. And besides, he had a role to play. So as they neared the hotel, Rapp fired off one anxious, paranoid question after another. The chief did his best to calm his guest, but Rapp played the inconsolable nervous wreck better than he could have hoped. They reached the Shady Cedar Hotel at 20 minutes past midnight. Ridley had hand-picked the hotel because it was smack dab in the middle of Indian country. All three men escorted Rapp into the lobby. The chief asked to have a private word with the manager, and the two men disappeared behind the closed door of the small office behind the reception desk. The other two policemen stood chain-smoking by the door, while Rapp stood at the front desk and did his best to look nervous as hell, which was no easy thing, considering the fact that he really wanted to kick down the door and pistol-whip the double-dealing police chief. After 5 minutes, Chief Haddad appeared, stroking his mustache and assuring Rapp that everything was taken care of. The little kiss-ass hotel manager joined in, telling Rapp that all would be fine. Rapp got the distinct impression that all would not be fine and that both of these men would look to make money by turning him in to Islamic Jihad. But that was the point of the whole crazy exercise. So Rapp anxiously shuffled his feet and kept rubbing his neck as if he was a wreck. Pointing toward the door, Rapp asked, "Can one of your men stay the night?" "I am afraid that is not possible. Besides, you'll be safe here." Rapp acted even more worried, but truth be told, he didn't have a worry in the world. He could sleep in peace, and then, in the morning, he could begin to ask around for information. The idea that the chief wouldn't tell the very people who had asked him to grab Hurley was ludicrous, but Rapp played dumb. The elevator was out of order, so he took the stairs to the fourth floor. He closed and locked the door to the room and wedged the rubber doorstop into the small gap at the bottom. Next, he opened the curtains to see what kind of exit the window might provide. It was a good 25 feet to the street. Ridley had sent him off with a grab bag of things, including a 30-foot coil of rope. Rapp tied one end to the foot of the bed and left the rest of it coiled by the window. Then he took out his silenced Beretta and Motorola radio. He set the gun on the nightstand and keyed the transmit button on the radio. Ridley's voice came over the radio a few seconds later. Rapp told him he'd made it to the hotel and was in his room. The radios weren't secure, so they kept the conversation vague and short. Rapp confirmed that he would check in at 8 and then every 2 hours after that. If he missed any of the check-ins, Ridley should assume Rapp had made contact. After that, it was anyone's guess how things would turn out. Rapp brushed his teeth and lay down on the bed with his clothes on. He didn't expect to sleep. But if he did, all the better. He lay there in the dark with his eyes closed, going over all of his options. In his mind's eye, he could see how things were going to proceed, and if he had any chance at all of making it back alive, he would have to stay calm and seize the opportunity if and when it presented itself. When it presented itself, he amended. Petrosian had said it himself, the Fatah and Islamic Jihad factions had grown thin during the ceasefire. Men were leaving their ranks and finding jobs. It was very possible that they would make a mistake. It was simply up to Rapp to see it coming and make his daring move. Rapp did fall asleep. He had no idea when he had dozed off or for how long, but it was enough to recharge his battery. He checked in with Ridley at the appointed hour, and then, not wanting to lose his nerve, he left the hotel and proceeded directly to Maurad Street a few blocks away. The vendors were manning their tents, selling all kinds of produce and food. Rapp worked his way up and down both sides of the street, speaking English and playing down his French when he had to speak it. He continued to play the role of the dolt. Almost to a man, people shunned him as soon as he asked about Colonel Syed. There was one man, though, who had opened up. He was selling electronics, small radios, tape players, and two-way radios like Rapp's Motorola. Rapp stepped into his small tent and said hello. There was a polite exchange, and then Rapp asked him, "Do you know anything about the two Americans who were picked up a few days ago?" The man pointed to two radios and loudly asked Rapp, "Which one do you like better?" And then, in a much quieter voice, he said, "Yes, I know of the Americans." He then stuck out his hand for cash. Rapp peeled off 7 $100 bills. The man pocketed the bills and picked up a small alarm clock radio. He began to explain its various features. In between lauding the various components, he lowered his voice and said, "There is a rumor that the Americans are being held in the basement of an old building on the west side of Martyrs Square." Before Rapp could ask another question, the man was stuffing the alarm clock in a bag and sending him off. That was when Rapp noticed the two guys with stern faces and distinctive bulges under their jackets. He went straight back to the hotel. He wanted to pass on this nugget of information before he was picked up. As he reached the street that the hotel was on, he turned left, which was the wrong way. He took two steps and then, acting as if he'd just realized his mistake, he turned left again and saw the two men halfway down the block, just standing there, staring at him. Rapp kept moving so as not to let them know that he was onto them. It was not lost on him that the two men following him had made no effort to conceal their interest. Rapp hustled up the next block, and when he entered the hotel, he noticed a new manager behind the desk, who gave him a very unpleasant look. Rapp supposed the man thought someone might blow up the hotel just because of his presence. As he climbed the stairs to the fourth floor, he realized you could hardly blame the guy. He was like some saloon keeper in one of those old Western movies where the troublemakers were all gunning for the new sheriff. When he got up to the room, he sat on the edge of the bed and collected his thoughts, trying to prioritize the various bits and pieces. The vendor was the only real highlight, and even that might be worthless. Was it a wild rumor or was it fact? Rapp knew that unless he had a chance to talk to the man, he would never be able to figure it out. The two men trailing him had him worried. Were they on their way up to his room right now, preparing to kick his door down and drag him off? Rapp thumbed the transmit button and said, "Curly, this is Mo. Over." The Three Stooges monikers was Ridley's idea. "I'm here, Mo. What's up?" "I just got back from the market. Two guys tailed me back to the hotel." "Not a surprise. How was the market?" "Pretty much treated me like a leper. Just like you said." "Yeah, bad part of town. They haven't seen a gringo around there in some time. I'm sure you were a big hit." "I did pick up one piece of information." Rapp paused, trying to figure out the best way to pass it along without giving too much away on an open channel. "Remember last night when our Armenian friend talked to us about the manpower issue?" There was a slight delay, and then, "Yep, I remember." "He referenced a local standoff, a land grab, kind of a standoff at the OK Corral." "I'm with you." "There was one vendor, cagey fellow, told me, on one side of the corral, the guys are keeping some things in the basement."
"I think I copy. Can you give me more on the source?"
"He sold electronics, boom boxes, small radios, clocks, that kind of stuff." Ridley asked for a description of the man and his stall, and Rapp gave it to him. Then Ridley said,
"I'll pass this on to the Armenian and see what he's heard. Anything else?"
"No," Rapp said as he crossed over to the window and pulled back the curtain. The two men who followed him had taken up positions directly across the street. "Those guys I mentioned have decided to camp out in front of the hotel."
"Not a surprise. You sure you still want to do this?"
Rapp had just been asking himself the same question.
But like his high school lacrosse coach used to say, you can't score unless you shoot.
"I'm fine," Rapp said into the small radio. "If I don't check in at noon, you'll know I'm either dead or in the middle of negotiations."
"Let's hope it's the latter."
"Roger that. Over and out." Rapp took off his khaki sport coat and went into the bathroom to splash some cold water on his face. He patted the drops of water with the towel
and looked at himself in the dusty, cracked mirror. Rap eyed his fractured reflection, his thick head of black hair, the beginnings of a beard, his bronzed olive skin, and his eyes so dark that they were almost black. He could walk among the enemy without getting so much as a suspicious glance, but that would all change if he didn't do something. Very carefully, he patted his hair, and then, using his index finger, he probed a little deeper. He could barely feel the small section of metal. Ridley had taken a flexible 14-inch bandsaw blade and cut it down to a neat little 3-inch piece. An eighth of an inch thick and only a half-inch wide, the black metal section was then threaded into his dark head of black hair. Rap played Ridley's words over again in his head. "We know from debriefings that these things follow a certain pattern. It usually starts with a whack across the back of the head, but not always. You're then tossed in either the back seat or the trunk, taken somewhere and stripped naked, and then moved one or two more times. There's a good chance you'll never be in the same building as them. Then again, they might be two doors down, and you'll never know they're there unless you get free." Rap stared at his reflection and questioned his sanity. "Are you fucking nuts?" Rap couldn't remember if he'd ever talked to himself out loud like this in the mirror. Maybe drunk, but never sober. It all flashed before him in that moment. He could slip out the back door and find his way back to the other side of town. Like Ridley had told him last night, if you get cold feet, no one will judge you. Except for himself, of course. Rap did not want to live the rest of his life that way. This wasn't like making a mistake in the heat of battle. This would be making a conscious decision to run from the field of battle, and not just to run, but to desert two of his fellow soldiers and leave them for dead. Rap knew himself well enough to understand that a failure of this magnitude would haunt him for the rest of his days. He pushed himself away from the mirror before he lost the courage. He checked the window again. They were still down there and had possibly been joined by another guy who was standing at the far end of the block. Rap looked over at his gun, which was on the night table. It had been suggested that, to complete his performance, he should leave the gun in the room, but he didn't like that idea. He'd rather walk out of the hotel buck-naked than leave the gun. He could explain it away as a precaution. Everyone else in this town walked around with a gun, so why shouldn't he? The radio was the only other thing to decide on. He chose to bring it with him. If he didn't get picked up right away, he might need to call Ridley with an update. As a precaution, he changed the channel and turned it off. Rap quickly scrawled a note and left it on the small desk in the corner, then put his sport coat back on and checked all the pockets. Everything was where it should be. Lifting the back of his jacket, he wedged the Beretta into his waistband and gathered his sunglasses, the map, and a large wad of cash, and headed for the door. He hesitated for a split second, then told himself not to think. "I'd rather go down swinging," he muttered as he shut the door. If he survived this little ordeal, he'd have to ask Lewis if talking to yourself was a symptom of losing your mind. Rap moved quickly down the four flights of stairs to the lobby. There was a new man behind the front desk, and he looked nervous as all hell, which Rap took as a sign that someone had talked to him. This was it, showtime. Rap continued out the front door into the blazing daylight and held his map above his head to block the sun while he looked up and down the street. Looking out from behind the sunglasses, he pretended not to notice a duo from Islamic Jihad. With his face buried in the map, he turned to the right and started heading east, as if he was going back to the market. Within half a block, Rap's nervous system began sending his brain alarms, each more frantic than the previous one. Now he was talking to himself again, but this time it was in his brain. The conscious, here-and-now, higher-functioning part was talking to the ingrained, lower-functioning part like a jockey talks to a thoroughbred as it's being led into the starting gate. "Easy," he repeated to himself over and over. It took every ounce of control to override his training and millions of years of basic survival instincts that were embedded like code into the human brain. Up ahead, Rap recognized a black car that was parked across the street. Earlier in the morning, the car had been empty. Rap ignored the man behind the wheel and turned down a narrow side street. Just 30 paces ahead, a rough-looking man was stationed in front of a shop. His left leg was straight and firmly planted on the pavement, and the other bent up behind him and placed against the side of the building. His big frame was resting against the wall while he took a long drag off his cigarette. The man had dusty black pants and a white dress shirt with sweat-stained armpits, and there was something vaguely familiar about him. Rapp wondered if he had been in one of the photos Ridley had shown him. The street was otherwise empty. The survivors of the bloody civil war could smell trouble, and they had wisely decided to stay indoors until the morning's sideshow was concluded. Rapp heard the men behind him, their thick shoes pounding out their progress and pace on the sidewalk. Suddenly a car engine revved, and the pace of his pursuers quickened. With every step, Rapp could feel them closing in from behind. His brain ran through options and avenues of escape, and he denied each one, willing himself to stay the course like a deranged ship's captain headed for the shoals at full speed. They were close now. Rapp could feel them. The big fellow up ahead threw his cigarette to the ground and pushed himself away from the building. He smiled at Rapp and produced a leather truncheon from his back pocket. It was at that moment Rapp realized who the man was. Rapp dropped the map in feigned surprise and turned to flee. The two men were exactly where he expected them to be, guns drawn, one pointed at Rapp's head, the other his chest. The sedan skidded to a stop just to his right, the trunk and front passenger doors swinging open. Rapp knew what was next. He closed his eyes and clenched his jaw as the truncheon cracked him across the back of the head. Rapp stumbled forward, his sunglasses clattering to the pavement. He fell into the arms of the two men with pistols. He let his legs go limp, and the men struggled with his weight. He felt the arms of the big man wrap around his chest and yank him upright. His 9mm Beretta was pulled from the back of his waistband, and he was dragged the short distance to the car's trunk. Rapp landed headfirst with a thud. The rest of his body was folded in on top of him, and then the trunk was slammed shut. The engine roared, and the rear tires bit through a layer of sand and dirt until they found asphalt. Rapp was thrown back as the vehicle shot away. He slowly cracked open his eyes and, as expected, found himself enveloped in darkness. His head was throbbing a bit from the blow, but not too badly. There was no fear on his face or doubt in his mind, though, just a smile on his lips as he thought of his childhood friend Cal Berkeley and his pet snake. Cal's pride and joy was his pet boa constrictor, Buckeye. When they were bored during the hot summer months, they'd go over to Cal's house and watch him feed rats to Buckeye. Well, one day, Cal came home from school to find Buckeye dead, with a hole in the side of his body and a bloody white rat still alive in the tank. Apparently, Buckeye had gotten lazy and swallowed the rat before it was dead. Once inside, the rat had then chewed its way out. Rapp couldn't help but smile at the thought of doing the same thing to these assholes. This was either going to be the most spectacular success of his life, or the end of it. Fear and debate no longer had a place in his thoughts. There was no turning back. No more hand-wringing. This was all about deception and action. The game had started. He was descending into the belly of the beast. The only question was, would he be able to eat his way out? Chapter 61. The Aeroflot Tupolev Tu-154 was cleared for landing on Beirut International Airport's only operating runway. Ivanov's bullish attitude was back. Primakov was backing him all the way on this little excursion. These Palestinian dogs thought they had everything figured out, but as usual, Ivanov was three steps ahead of them. Ivanov blamed himself for just one mistake during this entire miss. Why hadn't he thought of killing Dorfman first? All of that money could have been his. How could he have missed such an opportunity? Ivanov supposed he'd been blind out of necessity. In his world, a talented banker who knew how to skirt laws and hide money was absolutely essential. That was another problem he now had to deal with. Where was he going to find another man with those capabilities? He would have to fly to Hamburg soon after he delivered the Americans to Primakov. He would sit down with Dorfman's boss, Herr Koenig, and make him see that certain reparations were in order. Fietz had come up with the idea, get Koenig to authorize a few loans to shell companies that were in Ivanov's name and were run out of Switzerland, loans that would never be repaid. Fietz explained that a bank of this size wrote off more than $100 million a year in bad loans. If handled the right way, he could bleed Herr Koenig out of several million dollars a year. This opened up a whole new avenue of possibilities for Ivanov. He could apply the same principle with a few of the new bankers in Moscow. In only a few years, he could have all his money back and then some. That Fietz was a smart boy. Maybe too smart. Ivanov watched Svets exit the cockpit and close the door. As his deputy sat in the aisle seat next to him, he noted the way Svets glanced at his glass of vodka, barely able to hide his contempt.
"We will be on the ground in less than a minute,"
Svets announced while he fastened his seatbelt.
"Good. I am eager to get this over with and get back to Moscow."
Svets wondered what kind of man wished to be gone from a place before he'd arrived. Glancing out the window, Ivanov asked,
"Do you think we could persuade Herr König to visit us in Moscow early next week?"
"Doubtful,"
Svets said with a shake of his head.
"Well, try. If he won't come in to us, then I will go to him. As always, though, I would like to try to do this the civilized way first. Two businessmen exploring an opportunity.
In some countries they call it a shakedown."
Ivanov drained his glass and gave Svets an unhappy frown. Svets realized the sulking Ivanov was gone and the ruthless one was back.
"Sorry."
Ivanov did not reply at first. He had picked up on the man's growing insolence over the past year, but it seemed to have grown exponentially over the past week. Maybe it was time to replace him. The question was with whom. The private sector was exploding with opportunity, and the SVR no longer had the pick of the litter. He decided he shouldn't give up on him so easily. A good lesson or two might restore the proper attitude, and if that didn't work, he'd think about having him shot. Cutting him free would be foolish. Svets knew too many of his secrets. The plane landed on the relatively short runway and braked hard. While they taxied to the designated area, Svets leaned over and asked,
"What is our plan if the bidding goes over $5 million?
Ivanov laughed.
"It won't."
"How can you be so sure?"
"Because I am smarter than these dogs."
Svets was intrigued. "What have you been up to, sir?"
"Let's just say I made a few calls to my friends in Tehran and Baghdad."
"And?"
"They have agreed that it would be foolish to pay for something that I am willing to give them for free."
Svets was dubious.
"Are you sure you can trust them?"
The plane stopped in front of an old rusty hangar. The doors were open and light streamed into the interior from the holes in the roof. Syed stepped from the shadows and waved at the plane. Ivanov laughed at the sight of him.
"There are two things you need to know to understand the Middle East. The first is that they all hate the Jews. The second is that they have nothing but contempt for the Palestinians."
Chapter 62. It couldn't have been more than 5 minutes. The trunk opened, and they were on him. Rapp couldn't tell how many, but it was more than two and fewer than five. They punched, grabbed, and pulled, finally yanking him from the space and throwing him to the floor. Rapp tried to block the blows as best he could, but they were coming from too many directions, and besides, the goal was not to show them how skilled he was at fighting, it was to play possum. To that end, Rapp started screaming and begging them to stop. The ass-kicking did stop, but only because they began stripping him. When they were done, Rapp lay on the hard, dusty floor, whimpering. As best he could tell, they were in some type of bombed-out building. All of his clothes and possessions were thrown into the trunk of the car that he had just been yanked from. The vehicle started up again, and then the driver floored the gas and sprayed Rapp with loose gravel. The four men who were standing around him all started laughing. A fifth man walked into the circle. Rapp recognized him as the one who had been leaning against the building. He was a senior member of Fatah.
"Why are you doing this? I have been authorized by my government to negotiate with you."
Radi squatted on his haunches. He held out Rapp's Beretta.
"Why do you need this to negotiate?"
Rapp shrugged.
"This is a dangerous town. I don't know."
Radi slapped him hard across the face.
"I think you are a liar."
"Sorry."
"Shut up."
"But the money—" Radi slapped him again, and Rapp started to whimper.
"I'm just a messenger." "And what do you have to offer?"
"Money. Lots of it."
"How much?"
$1 million. Radi roared with laughter.
"I think it will cost you a lot more than that."
"Maybe I can get more money," Rapp said hopefully.
"And maybe we will sell you to the Russians with the others."
"I can get you the money."
"I don't care about the money, and besides—"
You do not seem like you would fetch a very good price.
The other men nodded and laughed. Roddy was suddenly curious about this man. He had to be very low level.
Why were you chosen to negotiate their release?
Rapp shrugged and didn't answer. Roddy slapped him. One of the other men kicked his legs and screamed,
"Answer him! I volunteered! Please don't hit me!" "And why would anyone volunteer for something like this?"
Rapp spoke softly into the floor.
"Speak up!"
"I said I'm related to one of the men."
"Related? To who?"
"Stan Hurley." "We don't have a hostage named Stan Hurley."
"Yes, you do. Hurley is his real name. You probably know him as Bill Sherman. That's why I volunteered. Please don't hurt me,"
Rapp pleaded. "I mean you no harm. I just want to get these men released. I promise we will not bother you again."
"How are you related to this Stan Hurley?"
"He's my dad."
Roddy could hardly believe his luck. He might not be able to kill Bill Sherman, but Syed had said nothing about his son.
Roddy stood. "Let's go," he announced to his men. "Tape his wrists and toss him in the trunk."
Rapp was as passive as he could be while they wound the duct tape quickly around his wrists. He counted 10 times and noted that they didn't bother to tape his ankles.
"I can make you guys rich,"
Rapp pleaded as they tossed him in the trunk of a different car. The trunk was slammed shut, and then they were off. He had no idea where they were to begin with, so the 20-odd-minute drive that they went on through the city was unnecessary. Just before they stopped, however, things became noticeably quieter, almost as if they were in the country. When the trunk popped again, Rapp was hit with a blast of sunlight. He glimpsed a building that looked like it was slated for demolition. 2 big men yanked him roughly from the trunk. Rapp's bare feet hit the rough ground, and he realized they were in an alley. The buildings on each side were riddled with pockmarks, and not one of them had a window. 2 blocks away, he caught a glimpse of blue. Before he could take in anything else, he was rushed into the building and down a flight of stairs. He was immediately hit by the smell of raw sewage. He almost gagged, and this time it wasn't for effect. The hallway was 10 feet wide, with rooms on each side. They were all missing doors except 3 rooms at the midpoint on the right. He noted the 2 guards with bandanas tied around their faces. They were the first men who had tried to conceal their faces, and then Rapp realized it was the smell. The men who had him by the arms yelled ahead to the guards to open the 1st door. They removed the padlock from the latch and swung the door open. With a good enough head start, Rapp thought he might be able to bust the latch off.
"Please," Rapp pleaded with the men, "I'm only an analyst. I can't do this. Please give me my clothes back and let me call Washington. I'll get you your money."
They tossed Rapp into the room like a rag doll. He tumbled to the floor, begging them to listen to him. Then the door was closed, and he was again enveloped in darkness. Rapp began to whimper, softly at first, and then a little louder. For some strange reason, this room smelled better than the hallway, almost as if it had been cleaned with bleach. He recalled the landscape in the alley and remembered the thin strip of blue on the horizon only a few blocks away. It was the sea for certain, and with all of the bombed-out buildings, it fit the general description of Martyr Square. The merchant must have been right. Rapp rolled onto his side and started digging through his thick hair. The fact that they hadn't covered his head with a hood worried him. He found a small blade and placed one end in his teeth. He set the blade against the top edge of the tape and began slowly moving his hands back and forth. Chapter 63. The stairs at the tail of the Russian plane were lowered, and Syed watched the soldiers in black fatigues file down the steps. He counted 30, all heavily armed, all Russian special forces. Syed had no doubt they were intended as both a show of force and an insult. Syed raised the radio to his lips and said, "You are right." Mugnia's voice came back, "How many men?"
30 Spetsnaz, heavily armed."
There was a long pause, and then,
"I will be there in 5 minutes."
Syed attached the radio to his belt and watched as the elite Russian soldiers spread out to cover the area. Finally, Shietz appeared, and then Ivanov. Both men were in suits and wearing sunglasses to protect their delicate Moscow eyes. As they approached, Ivanov yelled at Syed from across the tarmac. The big Russian threw out his arms and walked the final 10 paces as if it had been far too long since they had last seen each other.
Syed was not going to be a rude host, so he held out his arms as well, and, despite his misgivings, he greeted Ivanov with a smile. As much as he distrusted the man, there was something likable about him.
"Asef, my friend, how are you?"
Ivanov practically picked the Syrian up in his arms. "I am well. Thank you for coming." Ivanov pushed the Syrian intelligence officer away and held him at arm's length.
"What happened to your ear?"
Syed gently touched the bandage and said, "Oh, nothing, just a little accident."
"Other than that, you are well?"
"Yes." Ivanov peered over the top of his sunglasses at the hangar and the surrounding landscape, the bombed-out hangar, an airliner with only one wing and another with no engines.
"I see Beirut hasn't changed much."
"Things are getting better." Syed pointed back toward the construction equipment at the main terminal. "We thought privacy would be best for this meeting." He motioned toward the hangar, saying, "I promise it will be worth your effort."
"Yes, but what is this nonsense? I have to compete for my information like some rancher bidding on heads of cattle."
They started walking toward the shade of the hangar. Syed followed the script that Bugnia had given him.
"Yes, well, if it was up to me, it would only be you, but I am not the only one with a voice in this."
"Bugnia?"
Ivanov asked.
"Yes."
"I have warned you, he is in love with the religious zealots in Iran, and we both know they will never be the answer to a lasting peace in Beirut."
"I know, I know," Syed said, patting Ivanov's arm as they entered the hangar. "But there is only so much I can do."
"And you have been a staunch supporter. Do not think that has gone unnoticed."
Ivanov took off his sunglasses.
"Now, where are these Americans that we are all so interested in?"
Syed pointed to their left. In the shadowy recesses of the hangar, next to a rusty, broken-down truck, a man wearing a black hood sat in a single chair.
"But I thought there would be three."
"There are," Syed said. "Think of this one as a sample." Ivanov was not happy.
"I have flown all this way, and you play games with me. I do not like this, Asef."
"No games," Syed lied. "Security is very important. One of these Americans is such a big fish that we must be extra careful."
"What is his name?"
"I cannot say just yet."
"Why?" "We must wait for the others."
Ivanov looked around the empty space. Shvets and the Spetsnaz commander had wisely stopped 20 feet away to give them some privacy. Where were the representatives from Iran and Iraq? Turning back to Syed, he asked that exact question.
"They will be here any minute."
Ivanov checked his watch and huffed. His instincts told him something else was going on here.
"I do not like this. I do not like this one bit. I am on time. I have important business to attend to back in Moscow."
"I am sorry, Mikhail."
"Sorry will not work."
Ivanov leaned in close, so he was eye to eye with Syed.
"When you come to Moscow, I treat you like a prince. I come here and we meet in this."
He waved his hand around the dilapidated space. "Mikhail, I'm sorry. We do not have your resources.
And that is something you would be wise to remember. I do not deserve to be treated like this."
"I am sorry," Syed could only say again.
"If you are so sorry, you will stop playing games with me and tell me who this big fish is. And if you do not want to stop playing games, then I will be forced to start playing them as well. Maybe I will get on my plane and fly back to Moscow. You can conduct your little auction without me. Mikhail, I am—" "Don't say it again! If you are truly sorry, you will tell me who the mystery American is. If not, I am done playing games and I will leave."
Mugnia had specifically told him not to divulge that information until he was there, but Syed was growing weary of the man's paranoia. He did not trust Ivanov, but he couldn't see what harm could be caused by telling him about Bill Sherman. "I will give you a sneak peek, but you have to play dumb when Mugnia gets here." Turning, Syed said, "Follow me." As they walked over to a folding table, he said, "This American is rumored to have been heavily involved in some of the CIA's most sensitive operations, including operations directed at your country." There were three files on the table. Syed picked up one and handed it to Ivanov. Ivanov had been preparing himself for this for the past 24 hours. He had expected to see the man in person, but in a way, it would be easier for him to downplay his reaction this way. He opened the file, looked at the Polaroid photo of the American spy, and nearly gasped. Ivanov hid his emotions and tilted his head as if he were trying to place the face, even though he knew with absolute certainty who the man was. He and Stan Hurley had tangled